Mr. Obradovich, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom, which I think has now happened, and I apologize if I greatly mispronounced your client's name, but okay. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Obradovich, and I am the attorney for Charlene Pisona. In her appeal to this court from a decision made by the Honorable Judge Alan Broadbeck, County Judge of Valley County, Nebraska, sitting in probate. Ms. Pisona is the surviving spouse of Eldon Pisona, who died August 4th, 2013. The parties were married on September 24th, 2011. It was the second marriage for both parties. A small wedding ceremony was held on that date in Scotia, with a very large reception in Ord that evening. The parties had executed a prenuptial agreement the 23rd day of September 2011, one day before the wedding.
When did they start that process?
It appears from the testimony, there was a phone call from Mr. Pisona to attorney Greg Jensen sometime prior to the Monday before the wedding. So I believe it would have been, counting backwards, probably the 19th of September 2011. I believe the testimony shows there was a meeting on the Monday, a meeting on a Wednesday, and the signatures on the Friday, prior to the wedding.
Before the prenuptial agreement was executed, there were three meetings with the lawyers involving both parties?
It appears to be a meeting with Mr. Jensen, Attorney Jensen, with both parties.
Thank you.
Prenuptial agreement consists really of six pages, three pages of text, a notary page, and then Exhibit A, which was the exhibit of property owned by Mr. Pisona, and Exhibit B, the last page, property owned by then Charlene Vandesol. It is not disputed, however, that these lists were not an exhaustive list of the assets of Mr. Pisona.
What was left out?
Cash, farm equipment, and any valuations relative to the land. It's simply a series of legal descriptions, not even setting forth the number of acres or in whom that property was titled. Simply, appears to be a list of some of the property that he owned. And I think the same would be true for Ms. Pisona as well.
Was land the bulk of both parties' property?
With regards to the evidence in this case, I can only assert as to Mr. Pisona. I think the counsel has argued it is the vast majority of the property. It may very well be. It's certainly a majority of the property. Whether or not it's a vast majority, I can't answer. That would have been something he signed in 2011. He died in 2013. I have no knowledge. There's no evidence of anything that might have passed from him, either through sale or transfer or gift at all. All we have is what he listed on Exhibit A.
Well, having said all that, why is the prenuptial agreement not enforceable?
Prenuptial agreement fails in several areas. And obviously, the statute requires that there be a full disclosure of the assets of each party. At a minimum, you should list the property, you should list the value of the property, so the person signing the prenuptial agreement will understand what it is they're actually forfeiting or waiving an interest.
Does the statute say that the value should be listed? Excuse me.
That's my question.
I believe the statutes indicate that there has to be a disclosure of the property, and clearly the statute also talks about the relative ability to negotiate and understand fairly the interest of the parties. What you're waiving, how can anybody waive an interest in something if they don't know what it is they're waiving an interest
to? Is there a strict requirement or a substantial compliance?
I'm sorry?
Does the statute require strict compliance, or is substantial compliance good enough for prenuptial agreement?
I would not disagree with you that it's not strict compliance. It is substantial compliance. Mm-hmm. If taken as a whole, the court can determine whether or not the parties knew what they were doing when they signed it. In this particular case, there were no admonitions given to either party in writing that they could seek separate counsel. That opportunity apparently did not
come. Are you arguing fraud now or something else? That's not having separate counsel doesn't have anything to do with the validity of it, does it?
I'm not suggesting fraud. I'm suggesting that the agreement as written and as described to the parties did not tell them that they had an opportunity to seek separate counsel. And the statute does say there has to be there should be an opportunity for someone to be able to see separate counsel regarding the terms. That opportunity was never given. It is very hard for me to argue, in all fairness, that Mr. Jensen represented one party or the other. I think it's pretty clear that although Mr. Posada made the contact, I think he did attempt to gather the information and provide it to the parties. But even in that situation, a person who's going to sign the agreement should be given the advice that they should seek separate counsel should they have any questions.
Is it significant in this case that Charlene sort of requested and negotiated an amendment to the agreement?
I think it's significant until you read what that amendment to the agreement is. Ms. Posada testified that she lived in Greeley and had a house in Greeley and maybe selling that house in Greeley. And so she was concerned that in the event of Mr. Posada's death, that she would somehow have to leave. So the parties told the lawyer what they would like to have, and that agreement indicates a one-year right to stay on the property. That is insignificant to the overall value of that to which she may be entitled. And again, if you take the position that she simply did not understand the consequences of what she was waiving.
Didn't she testify just the opposite? She did understand that what she was doing was waiving, both of them were waiving any rights to the other's property.
Most of her testimony, well, in my opinion, my recollection of the testimony is that she talked about her children's interest. She had some interest, obviously, in her own property. She was retaining that. That's what the document says. But in this particular case, when you understand that the estate is $10 million, it makes a pretty big difference as to what decision you're making to what you're giving up. And the time frame is critical here. One of the terrible things that we put people in the position of when it comes time that they're going to be getting married and a couple of days before, when all these plans have been made, somebody says, here, I need you to sign a prenuptial agreement.
Isn't that a typical situation?
Well, maybe typical, but it doesn't make it fair. This decision to be married was in December of the year previous.
To return to the language of the statute, are you contending that there was something that was not voluntary about your client's signing of this agreement?
I think voluntariness comes from intelligently, voluntarily knowing what you're doing.
But that's adding words to the statute. The statute says voluntarily. Did she sign it voluntarily?
I think her testimony would be that she did not sign it voluntarily because she did not understand all of the attributes of the agreement. She was not coerced. They didn't sit down, force her to sign the document. I suppose you could have said she could have walked away. But at that particular time, in that relationship, in those circumstances, I think it would be unreasonable to expect her to do that.
Didn't the agreement provide that each party expressly understood that it was going to be, that the disclosures were in general terms?
Yes.
And that was an element of the agreement. So all this specificity that you're talking about now and complaining was absent was actually contemplated by the agreement itself, wasn't it?
Sure, but it presumes that people understand what it is they're signing. Simply put boilerplate language in an agreement and presume that somebody understands everything that they're signing and what those waivers mean, I think is really unrealistic.
Did the agreement identify the real property by legal description?
It did.
Was there anything in the record that suggests the parties didn't have the ability during that week or at any time to get on the assessor's website and learn the valuation of those?
Those questions were not asked, and there's no evidence to support that they could or could not.
What does the record show about your client's assets, and is that relevant to this case?
I think she testified that the information she gave to the attorney is the information that ended up in the agreement. She was never asked for valuations. She was never asked for anything except just the legal description. She wasn't asked to list your cash or equipment or any other trust assets that she may have. None of that was ever even discussed. So in all fairness, her exhibit is as bare as his exhibit. But I don't think that necessarily makes it correct. I think if somebody's going to be told that you're waiving your rights, I think they have to know what rights they're waiving, what assets they're giving up.
What's the legal standard for unconscionability in this context?
In terms of review?
What's the legal standard that needed to be proven?
I think the legal standard that she would have to show, the burden is on her to prove unconscionability. I think it's her testimony taken as a whole, that even through clear and convincing evidence, she did not know what she was signing.
So you're saying that the standard for unconscionability is knowledge of what you're signing?
I think that's correct. That's what I'm saying.
Have we ever said that?
I'm sorry?
Have we ever said that?
I can't answer that you have or have not. I'm sorry, I don't know. We'd ask you to overturn the decision of Judge Bryant. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. York, good morning to you.
Good morning. I please the court. My name is Mark Urick, and I represent one of the co-personal representatives in this case, Janice Brown. With regard to the matter before you, we consider the case basically a case very similar to a number of different cases where we have couples that have previously marriages that have ended and have children of those previous marriages. That the parties decided to go ahead and do a prenuptial, and the reason for that is obviously to protect the children with regard to the assets that they're going to receive, and also to protect their own assets that they have acquired during the years prior to this marriage. In this case, we believe that the correct statute in this case is 302316. That statute basically says that rights to inheritance, by in this case the attempt by the admitted spouse, can be waived by the execution of a prenuptial agreement. That goes on further to say that the prenuptial may not be enforceable, however, if the surviving spouse proves that she didn't execute it voluntarily, that the waiver was unconscionable, didn't fairly disclose things to her, including the she didn't waive a right to disclosure or didn't have any or couldn't have had any adequate knowledge. So we believe, Your Honor, that in order for the appellant to be successful, they would have had to prove all of those elements. And the lower court did not decide that they proved that. And we believe that the record indicates in this case that, that the parties on several occasions met with the attorney, that there was a discussion ahead of time that there was going to be a meeting of the attorney, that there was items negotiated at that time by the appellant that allowed her to be able to stay longer in the house. She obviously understood that at the point of death of her husband-to-be,
half of $10 million is a lot of money. Does the record reflect that somebody really understood what they were doing in this situation, that the spouse knew what she was doing?
I think the spouse, the record indicates that the spouse had handled farming, ranching enterprise for a number of years prior to that. In fact, her husband was a quadriplegic, and she was the main manager with regard to that farm. She was aware of land valuations, orders, and different things like that. She engaged in farming enterprises herself. You know, it's not in the record, but obviously there was a substantial increase in real estate values approximately at the time that they were going together, and also when the marriage occurred. The values probably tripled during the few years that were there, so where it looked like maybe in 2011 that would have been a small amount, it grew to a larger amount at that time. Of course, it's decreasing now again, but that's the way of the real estate values amount to. With regard to the real estate that was listed, if you look at, and there's part of the record, the place on the record is the valuation of Mr. Lasota's estate. There is, probably over 80% of the estate that value was identified on a parcel-by-parcel basis on the Exhibit A that was attached.
Does the record tell this court the approximate value of the wife's listings or the wife's property?
It does not. I don't believe there's anything in the record except that both indicated that the real estate was the substantial vast majority of the assets.
Is that relevant to what we're doing here today?
I'm sorry?
Is that relevant to what we're doing here today, the value of her property?
The value, I think, is relevant only to the extent that she, it wasn't relevant to her. She admitted in her testimony in the record that she didn't care about net worth. That was not an issue to her at the time of the marriage. So the question at that point is money a value? First of all, I think you have to find that that she didn't voluntarily sign it, and that she admits there's no coercion. She admits that it was signed at that time. They went through the negotiations and did that. Even if you consider that there was somehow some involuntariness of that, you'd have to say that the document itself was unconscionable.
Counsel, if unconscionability means sort of being manifestly unfair or inequitable, if you take the contract context of unconscionable, could any court make a decision on whether it was inequitable without knowing what both parties' net worth is?
Whether or not that you think that's, on its face, I think you have to look at the document and say, is this something that is patently unfair to either side? If we disclose what happens to the property, your property that you have at this time, did you know that you were not receiving any of the other person's property? I don't know that you have to look behind to see exactly what the valuation is to weigh the scales to determine whether or not a contract is invaluable. I think there is a previous case of the Court of Appeals in Edwards where they had a doctor who was there, obviously had substantial assets, and they said, and obviously more experienced than the person who was signing that, they said in that case that the document was straightforward.
Whose burden was it to prove unconscionability?
Unconscionability is the burden of proof of the appellant.
Do you believe that was met?
No, Your Honor. Not. And, I think the lower court agreed that there was not an issue with regard to that. They said that she voluntarily signed it. I don't think you have to reach the issue of even unconscionability unless you find that she was not voluntarily signed it. That's my interpretation of the statute. Now, the other statute that was quoted is the prenuptial alone statute, which has an or in there, allows you to be successful if you have either of those elements that are set forth. And I don't believe in that case. This one specifically talks about the probate part of it, and I've been identified by several different recent decisions that it relates only to that. So I think you have to find all of those different things in order for her to be successful.
Counsel, the absence of the or came about in the same legislative act, LB 202 in 1994, where the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act was adopted, and with respect to the premarital agreements, did include an or. What are we to make of a legislative act where on the one hand it includes the or with respect to people who are premarital agreements, but does not include the or with respect to waivers under the probate code?
Well, I believe there's good policy decisions for not having the or in the issue as it relates to estates and people who are deceased. First of all, we do not have the decedent here to be able to say his side of the story, what happened during the negotiations, what were the concerns at that time. Besides, we have a situation where parties lived together. If there would have been an issue with regard to the premarital, it could have been brought up in an earlier time period. policy decisions, but wanting to make sure that those premaritals are upheld and followed through, I think, are very important to us as planners to try to make sure that we don't have problems down the road with people who are getting married, wondering, are these assets ultimately going to go to the children? Because there's a lot of conflict, obviously.
So your view is the plain language of the statute requires, in the case of a decedent, that the opponent must prove both that it was not voluntary and that it was unconscionable and that there were one of some other circumstances.
That is my reading.
Regarding the disclosure and so on. Okay, thank you.
No further questions.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? No time for rebuttal. The next case of the day.